Hi, and welcome to The Attitude. This is Lincoln Mitchell filling in for Arnie Arneson. Arnie is out on assignment, so I will be hosting today. Just in case you haven't heard me on the show before, I'm a frequent guest on the Rethink the Week. I'm also a professor of international affairs and political science at Columbia University. And if you want, for any reason, to hear more from me, you can subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. It's Friday, so as usual, our first guest is Scott Braddock. And Scott is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, and the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And I'm just going to read you one sentence from his bio because I think it's really extraordinary. A product of rural Texas, Scott began his radio career at the age of 16 in Brenham spinning records. Remember what those are? These kind of vinyl things. They're black. They're had a lot of music on.
Some people
on
remember that.
And reading school lunch menus on the air. So when he was reading school lunch menus at the age of 16, I was working construction in San Francisco, so we can maybe bond about our weird 16-year-old jobs. One day, my job to prevent theft on the job site was to paint all of the ladders bright pink. That's how you do it. So, Scott, welcome to The Attitude.
You know, thanks for mentioning that. I was thinking just the other day about how whether it was radio back then or podcasting now or radio and TV appearances that I do all the time now across Texas, I'm coming up on 30 years of broadcast, which, you know, that may not be exactly reflected by my performance each week. I tell people I just kind of stumble through everything every time. It's been my whole career. It's been fun.
It sounds fun. 30 years, you know, it's been about 30 years of me teaching, which I find amazing and really fascinating because of the differences. And I have to say, I'm not one of these middle-aged people who scratches my head and says, oh, these kids today. I look at a lot of these young people, and it's one of the few reasons I have any hope for the future.
Well, that's a cool deal. And, you know, I see that in one of the absolute most rewarding things about what I do now as someone who is more of a senior member of the press corps here in Texas is get to watch people come into politics as very young people, whether that's staffers, lawmakers themselves. In some cases, it's lobbyists. In other cases, it's journalists, and watch them grow up. You know, they come right out of college, they get their first job, you know, at the Texas Capitol or wherever in Houston or Dallas. And, you know, you see what they're up to, you get to know them, and then you check in on them again a few years later. And for some of your students, this will probably sound familiar. For some of them, you think, I know exactly why they're doing that now, because I could see that, but whatever it is they're doing now, I could see that they were on that path a few years ago. And then others, you might scratch your head and go, how did they end up there? You know, whatever, in whatever position it is. So it is fun to see that happen.
I remember I was doing a project years ago when I was on an email chain, and there was a name on the chain, and the guy emails me one individually and says, I was your student in your class. I believe it was a class on democracy in graduate school. And then we ended up working on this project together. And at one point in the project, we took a weekend trip. We were in Jordan, and we took a trip to the desert. And we had to stay in these tents, you know, overnight. And he and I were sharing a tent just because of the way it broke down. You know, we were two guys, we were sharing this tent. And he said, as we were kind of going to sleep in the middle of this desert in this tent in Jordan, he said, I wonder what the other students from that seminar would think if I told them I was sleeping in a tent with you tonight. And I said, I wonder what my wife would think if I told her I was sleeping with one of my students in a tent tonight.
Yes, they would probably have all kinds of thoughts about that. Maybe some could not be repeated on the radio.
But it was all kosher. Anyway, you know, for a number of years now, I've heard about this migrant crisis. Okay. And I've heard about this emergency, this crisis at the border. And, you know, whereas I don't live in a border state, I live in a state where we certainly have a lot of migrants in a city, New York City. And my view, of course, is that there's one thing New York City does well, it's welcome immigrants to the United States. And if our mayor can't handle migrants from other countries, maybe he should step aside and find somebody who wants to take a real crack at the job. But Texas has been at the center of this. Yeah. And we've heard endlessly about this emergency. And then in the last couple of weeks, we've learned that it's not an emergency at all, at least from the view of the Republican Party, that, well, on balance, it's important, but, you know, it's more important to make Donald Trump look good. And I'm wondering, is that the right take on this? Am I missing something here?
I mean, there's some other things to fill in, but yeah, I mean, I think you're on track. Look, Texas is at the center of whatever migration patterns are happening in the United States because we have the longest border with Mexico. It's where most of the immigration, either legal or illegal, happens along the Rio Grande. And look, I think it's apparent to me as somebody who has covered immigration. From the policy perspective and the political perspective, Lincoln, for at least about 15 years, if not almost 20 years, I have to go back and think about it. It really became central to a lot of my reporting here in Texas when the issue was hijacked by the right wing of the Republican Party. So I go back to 2006, and you remember at that time you had former Governor Bush, George W. Bush, was in the White House. In the 06 elections, you remember what happened. The Democrats, ran the table. And the next day after the election in 06, George Bush he woke up in the morning, he went and did a press conference, and he said, we took a good Texas, we would say back home, we took a good Texas thumping last night as Republicans. But he saw an opportunity. And this just doesn't happen anymore in Washington in any way, shape, or form. At that time, because he had began to sense that within his own party, there was this nativism growing and this, anti-immigrant sentiment was growing. Now that he had a Democratic majority in the U.S. House, he saw an opportunity to pass immigration reform. And remember, the immigration laws of this country have not been updated since 1986. As I made the point to Arnie last week, everybody's talking about Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift was not even born yet the last time they updated the immigration laws in the U.S. She was born in 1989, 3 years later. And so if you think about what they were crafting at the time, and that was also under a Republican president, that was Ronald Reagan, that law that we have now that you hear all the time, Republicans saying, just enforce the laws that we have. That's all we need to do. That law was crafted for the immigration and economic and cultural realities of 1986, not the year of our Lord 2024. And so if you go back to 2006, you started to see in 06 and 07, you saw the outlines of what the Trump base would be. And let me explain what I mean. In 2006, Governor Perry at the time was up for re-election, and he faced three challengers. It was a four-way race. And it was the first big political contest in Texas where immigration was front and center. And at the time, you can still see this on YouTube. Perry was running these television ads. It was the centerpiece of his campaign. He ran these ads where he would stand on the river in his Carhartt jacket and his blue jeans, and he would say this. Tell me if this sounds familiar. He would say, "If Washington won't secure this border, Texas will." Now, that was with a Republican in the White House. And that was when Republicans were starting to revolt against George W. Bush. They thought he was too soft on immigration. Think about where the Republican Party has come on this. Governor and then President Bush, what he would say is that family values don't end the Rio Grande. We have, he would say, we want these people here. Texas benefits from, culturally and economically from robust migration and always has. But what you have now, and this is a huge difference, I'm sure you've noticed this, what you have now is a Republican Party that is just willing to say out loud that the reason that they're either doing something or not is political. At the time, when George, think about George W. Bush's big push for immigration reform didn't work out. And at the time, the way that Republican opponents of his proposal would talk about it was just to say that it wouldn't work. It wasn't feasible. They didn't agree with it. They were offering policy reasons for it, and at least trying to have the veneer that they were doing it in good faith. Right now, what happens? Marjorie Taylor Greene, Donald Trump himself, and others will just say out loud. We had Troy Nehls, who is a congressman from Texas. He's from the Houston area. I saw an interview that he did a few days ago where he said, "Look, we don't want to give President Biden a win on this issue because the President Trump is going to beat up Biden about it all the way through the fall. So we don't want to take an arrow out of the quiver of Donald Trump." Lincoln, they just say it out loud. I mean, it used to be that if a deal fell apart in Washington on something like this, those of us who follow politics closely would have to fill in the gaps about what the political realities are and why they were doing it from a political perspective. Now we don't have to guess. They just say it out loud. They'll say, we're not going to have a deal on this because that would be to the detriment of Donald Trump as he's running for president against Biden. They don't want to give Biden a win on this. And of course, on the Democratic side, I think it's fair to say that, look, they'd like to have the issue off the table, right? They would like to, you know, because there has been, as you said, you pointed out at the beginning of this, you've even got Democratic mayors now bitching and complaining about immigrants who are coming in. Of course, this is with, with our governor, Greg Abbott, busing migrants and now flying migrants to some of those places. But look, there is a pain threshold that's been hit to where even some Democrats are saying, let's get this issue off the table and move forward. Republicans were, I think, at least some of them were acting in good faith. But then all of a sudden, no, Donald Trump started calling people on Capitol Hill and saying, don't do that deal because that's going to hurt my bid for the White House.
There's so much here, but I want to just first talk about migrants in New York, because I just want to note that you know, I live in a neighborhood in Manhattan where there's been a lot of migrants coming to what used to be SROs and are now they're housing migrants. And what happens in my neighborhood is the woman who's kind of the mayor of my street sends an email out telling us what needs to be donated or who's looking for an apartment. So I think across, and I suspect it's not just my one neighborhood in Manhattan. I think there are a lot of American people that are trying to really bring the right values here and to help people who are in dire need, regardless of the games the politicians are playing. But yeah. I want to ask a question here, because you said something important, which we hear a lot. The Republicans don't want to give Biden a win, but yeah. I think they just gave him a huge one. And I'll tell you why. The bill was not something about which the base of the Democratic Party was ecstatically happy.
Right.
This was a bill you would expect to be written by, I don't know, a conservative senator from Oklahoma, because it was.
Right.
So Biden gets to take credit for trying to solve the problem, gets to, whenever Trump raises it, he said, well, you told people not to sign the bill, and he doesn't end up with a bill that alienates his base. Am I reading this wrong, or is this potentially a very big win for Biden?
Well, what I wonder is, I think you've got that right, but I wonder how durable that is. Because, and here's what I've noticed about the immigration, the potency of the immigration issue, politically for Republicans versus Democrats. And listeners of the show have heard me say this a few times, but I'll repeat it now because it relates to your question. With Republicans, no matter what's going on with immigration, whether migration patterns are up or down, the numbers are up or down, where the people are coming from, no matter what the facts are, the base of the Republican Party stays the same level of angry about it. No matter what, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if almost nobody's coming in or lots of people are coming in. They stay pissed about it no matter what. And so Republican politicians are able to tap into that to motivate their base. With Democrats, it's more fact-based. When would Democrats get mad about this? You remember the pictures of the kids in cages when there were family separations and, people were angry at President Trump for doing that. And the pushback from Republicans was, well, who built those cages in the first place? Obama did some of that. In fact, remember, to your point, Democrats were angry, or some liberals were angry with President Obama when he was in office, because at that point, he had deported more undocumented people than any president in history.
He's referred to as the deporter in chief by many in the left.
You got it. So with Democrats, if you had, this is my point, I guess, on this, if you had a deal struck now that absolutely, as you said, you got it right, is a more conservative. I mean, this in no way, shape or form, the proposal they're talking about in the Senate, this is not comprehensive immigration reform at all. This is a border security deal, right? This is giving the president authority to, quote unquote, shut down the border. Now, even the Border Patrol and the Border Patrol Union have come out and said, like, this would be a pretty good deal for what they want to see happen, which it's interesting. The talking heads on Fox News and some other places, they love the Border Patrol until the Border Patrol says that we should have, some sort of legislative fix right now. But look at what's happened even within the GOP here from Texas. Congressman Dan Crenshaw and Congressman Chip Roy. These people are not liberals. These are, of course, they'll be called rhinos, Republicans in name only for this, which if Chip, let me just say this. If
Chip Roy is a rhino, I'm Joe Biden. It's insane.
Well, if Chip Roy is a rhino, then it's a word. The word has no meaning, right? It put it this way. It's a word in name only. It should be a wino.
A wino.
So if Chip Roy is a rhino, give me a break. Roy and Crenshaw have both said that we do need to have some sort of legislative fix for this, while a lot of the Republicans, their colleagues, have said, no, no, just enforce the laws that we have. Crenshaw, I thought it was really interesting. He said, look, if people don't believe that we need new laws, then why did they write House Resolution 2? Why did they do H.R. 2? Because they knew they needed to do something. And Chip Roy on the floor of the House, in the well of the House there, he said that look, he called Trump, President Trump out and said, look, Trump acts as if he had this all fixed. But was the border shut down in any of the years that that Trump was there? Hell no. And here's the other thing I would say about all this. It is, I think, unfortunate that, and this is not for all Republicans, but for the right wing of the party, for the Fox News crowd and others who talk about border security in a really one-dimensional way, when this is such a complicated issue. Think about the fact that when you're talking to Democrats and Republicans, the Republicans have really won the framing argument on this. The only way that people know how to talk about it, the only way that they accept talking about it, the only metric anybody looks at for whether the border is secure, is how many people are coming across. People think if there are lots of people, then it's not secure. And if there are almost no people or no people, then it is secure. The question shouldn't be how many people are coming or not. The question should be whether our policy makes sense or not. I mean, look, take Texas as the prime example. What we had before 9/11 in this state was what we would refer to as an elastic workforce. So if you look at industries like construction, hospitality, agriculture, et cetera, which do need migrant workers, because I'm sorry to tell you, native-born Americans just won't do those jobs in large numbers. Elon Musk is running around talking about illegal immigration and cracking down on it now. Right where I live here in Austin, Texas, here in Travis County, he has the giant Tesla Gigafactory. Are you telling me that they built that factory with no migrant labor? Give me a break. I may have been paying attention to the Texas construction industry for more than a decade. That's a joke. So what we had, when I say elastic workforce, what I mean is people would come from Mexico to do those jobs that are seasonal when the jobs were available. And when the job was done, they'd go back home to Mexico. But after 9/11, the border has been so, quote unquote, secured that making that trip is just a horrible experience. They don't do it. They eat people. These folks who say that they want to keep migrants out, the net effect of militarizing the border and making it so difficult to make the trip into the United States, the net effect is that people come here and they stay here, documented or not, because they're not going to make that trip multiple times if they don't have to. Here's what happens, Lincoln. If somebody wants to make the trip from Mexico, and now we have so much guns, so much firepower, the razor wire that you've seen on television, it is at least portrayed and understood to be such a dangerous trip. People don't make the trip on their own. They ask for the help of a human trafficker, of the coyotes along the border. They'll charge them thousands of dollars per person to bring them into the United States. And if that person is apprehended and sent back, the same group of people, the same family, will pay the same people the same amount again to try to bring them back in. What we've done basically is we've militarized the border to the point where the only folks who can compete with the firepower are the drug cartels and the human traffickers. And and in the meantime, we've got, mothers and children drowning in the Rio Grande. And there's no proposed solution for any of that. Just a lot of finger pointing about whose fault it is.
And there's another point I would raise here, which is, Governor Abbott in Texas has really, and we've heard, and if you're not from Texas, you hear this bubbling up every now and then, which is that Texans somehow believe that they can secede. This is something that my Texan friends I met in other places have said, as if it's written. And if you've studied the U.S. Constitution for, 15 minutes, that's not true. And if you've studied the American history for, 15 seconds, you know that we have had a moment in our history when a bunch of states tried to secede. I wouldn't say that ended peacefully. But what Abbott seems to be doing here is very significant, in that the border is a state issue, whereas it's very clear in our Constitution and our laws that borders are national issues. So on the one hand, this is very much about the border, but it's also about Governor Abbott taking real steps to break down, to accelerate the potential disintegration of the United States. And he doesn't seem bothered by that because his guy isn't in the White House. Am I reading that right?
I think there are some parallels with other things with history. History rhymes, right?
Right.
And in the history of the United States, The things that happened that led to, literally a civil war. People keep talking about a civil war now. It's not without precedent, but think about the things that happened during the civil rights movement. Think about George Wallace standing in the doorway of the school so the African-American kids couldn't come in. And how you have Governor Abbott putting up razor wire and putting troops in the way so that brown people can't come into the United States, can't come into Texas. And the governor here today, I mean, I don't think this is a stretch to say that the governor here today is daring Biden to do what the president did at the time with Wallace, which is send in, federal, troops to federal authorities to come in and have a confrontation about where these people can go. Right. The immigration issue, as somebody who's covered this for, as I said, about 15 years, there are plenty of people who are acting in, on the right. There are plenty of people who are acting in good faith and want an orderly immigration system. And they think that, what we have right now is not that. When you hear people talk about law and order, the law and order Republicans, I think that what normal people, average people, and the reason that this their argument has some appeal beyond the Republican base is because what people don't like to see is something that's disorderly. When they talk about law and order, it's the order part that matters, right? It's the same thing that happens with homelessness policy, right? As people see that there are homeless people around, their city, they're upset about that. If they just couldn't see them, they wouldn't be mad, right? And so what you have right now on the immigration issue is a lot of people who are not acting in good faith and don't really care about a policy outcome. As you started out this conversation, there are those who will just admit and say out loud that all they want is to be able to flog the president with this as a political issue rather than solve anything. And I think that, there needs to be, look, for the overall, good of the United States going forward, having a piece of legislation that is only focused on border security really isn't the key. We need to have an update to our immigration laws overall that reflects the economic and cultural realities of the year 2024. I mean, the way we solved and Governor Perry, the former governor here, talked about this a lot. We essentially solved our migration issues with Mexico through economic policy. Remember, the people who are coming in now are not, they're coming, through Mexico, but they're not coming from Mexico. What used to happen before 9/11 and leading up to, maybe the mid 2000s was you had so many people coming from Mexico. Why? Because they were escaping crushing poverty. What happened to fix that? Well, this is something that a lot of liberals don't like, but it's interesting now is that you had the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, by the way, Trump trashed, right? But because we did work in partnering with Mexico to improve the economy there, Mexicans had less reason to come here. Right. They don't need jobs here if they have jobs there. And, Governor Perry talked about the fact that the oil and gas industry, really exploding in Mexico, a really good source of jobs, not just for people in Mexico, but also in South Texas. So you have Democrats from Texas who are all for the oil and gas industry. As they don't fall in line with the rest of what the mainstream of the Democratic Party thinks nationally. But we have done none of the same kind of work with those Northern Triangle countries, places in South and Central America that they have crushing poverty and they have these warlords who are in charge of things that people are trying to escape from horrible conditions. Those are the push factors out of those countries that bring people here. And why does anybody move from one place to another? Why does somebody, I always say this to my Republican friends, because they love to brag about how people in California want to move to Texas. Well, they have people from some of these other countries want to move to Texas too. Why does anybody move to Texas or any other place? Because they believe that the life they'll have where they're going is better than the life where they are. And they want better for their kids and they want better for their families. And if we would do more to, and this is where, Trump hijacking the Republican Party has put him in, remember the comparisons between Trump's economic policies and Bernie Sanders' economic policies, more of the isolationism, protectionism, and we're not going to work with these other countries. It's so cutting off your nose to spite your face, because if you don't want to see so much migration that you think is so terrible, then we would be doing the real work to make sure that people have a good life wherever they are.
And just as we wrap up here, just make a couple of points. It is also true that people want to come to the United States right now because the economy is booming. the joblessness rate is so low here that there are opportunities for migrants, immigrants, asylees from other countries. This is the Biden economic boom. You made a really important point about law and order, that people in some visceral sense prioritize order over law. But it's also important to remember that law and order, we think of them as like peanut butter and jelly. They always go together, but they're not the same. Order can be unlawful. Order comes from power, not from the law. And and the last point that I just want to make as we wrap up here is that what you've identified, Scott, is a failure of governance. And it is the Republican Party, as you say, saying the kind of quiet part out loud, which is that we are not interested in governance. We are not interested in solving problems. We are interested in elevating our cult leader, Donald Trump, full stop. And on that, Scott, I've got to let you go. But this was a great discussion. I always, if I'm going to discuss Texas politics with anybody, I want it to be you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
What's the story on Supreme Court justices and ethical standards? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The Senate Judiciary Committee has voted in favor of legislation that would impose new ethical rules on the members of the Supreme Court. The proposal has come about because of the recent revelations about justices having received lavish vacations and private jet trips and educational expenses for a relative paid for by politically involved billionaires, none of which did they disclose, all of which we know about only because of investigative reporting. To these revelations, various justices have responded that they broke no law or ethical rules because nothing requires them to reveal this information. And indeed, ethics laws that apply to other federal judges and members of Congress don't cover the Supreme Court, which is what the proposed legislation would change by requiring justices to abide by the same ethical and disclosure rules as members of Congress. Nothing more and nothing less. Which is a horrible idea, according to South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who has announced that the bill has no chance in the Senate, where 60 votes are necessary to overcome a filibuster. As for the House, pundits say the bill wouldn't survive a vote there either. So, the answer to the question, has the time come for the Supreme Court to be bound to unambiguous written ethical standards regarding disclosure and transparency? The answer to that question apparently is no. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
Lake Ontario Drumlins on this current cast. Drumlins are long, narrow hills that were created by glaciers thousands of years ago. In New York, drumlins start on the southeastern shore of Lake Ontario and extend south for miles. John Hollander is retired from the Oswego County Soil and Water Conservation District. He says wind and waves erode the northern edge of those drumlins, cutting away the gentle slope and creating
a very steep, sloped-faced remnant of what the drumlin used to be. And that's what we call bluffs.
These bluffs are dramatic cliffs that rise up from the edge of the lake and create fascinating shapes. And they provide the shoreline with stunning vistas. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant. Online at currentcast.org.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 20
2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
For change.
Welcome back to The Attitude. This is Lincoln Mitchell filling in for Arnie Arneson. Arnie is out on assignment. For the second half of today's show, I'm joined by Bill Curry. Bill is an American lawyer and politician who has been the two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut and was a White House advisor in Bill Clinton's administration. He was also head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Bill, welcome to The Attitude.
Great to be with you, Lincoln. Thank you.
And Bill, I'm going to maybe take advantage of your legal background here because it's been a busy week. Many weeks are busy weeks, but this one feels particularly busy in the legal trials of Donald Trump. And there's two, I think, related cases. The first is that in what, from my layperson's view, seemed like an extraordinarily weak argument made by Trump and his people, turns out the president is not immune to any prosecution and can't do whatever he wants forever. And that seems to have come as a surprise and a disappointment to the Trump team.
Yeah, they were shocked. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. And I can guarantee you that you could go through all the articles written in the National Review and any other right-wing periodicals of that time and not find a single suggestion that Nixon wouldn't need a pardon. Because he was immune. I don't think, and I would make a smaller bet with a little less certainty that that you could Google the entire history of our jurisprudence and our journalism, and not find this suggestion even being made a single time, even by some fanatic, until now. And of course, it is on its face preposterous that because you were once president, you could murder someone and not be charged. The lawyer who actually made that claim that he could only be charged with murder if he'd previously been impeached. And I thought, geez, it's too bad that all the members of Monty Python aren't sitting on the bench right now to give him the kind of response that this argument really deserves. But we're moving past it.
There's always, much in the kind of, when you look at the Supreme Court, there's always this constitutional minutia, which I believe is often disingenuous. It's just a way to get to the ideological place they want to end up. And if you read the Constitution, even not that closely, it's very clear that this argument has absolutely no merit. But if you go back even before that and look at the basic problems we were trying to solve with the Constitution, which is that we don't have kings in this country. No one has unlimited power. And the Constitution is deeply based on trying to check power. And I don't understand how this argument gets 5 minutes down the road, except for that it's Donald Trump. What strikes me now is that, the cost of entry into MAGA world, which is the Republican Party, since January 6th of 2021, has been to believe in the big lie. If you believe, which, by the way, is the truth, that Joe Biden won the election and is the legitimate president of the United States, which is, in fact, the truth, you can't be part of GOP discourse anymore. And now it seems that that is going to take another step, which is that if you believe that Donald Trump at any point in his life can be held responsible for any action he does, then you're a rhino or something. And this is just kind of another tightening of Trump's personal grip on the party at the expense of standing for anything else.
It is. If you know nothing else about the Constitution, you've probably heard the phrase checks and balances. And that, of course, was the whole point. And this doesn't just violate some constitutional provision. It violates the entire concept of the country, self-evident mission of the Constitution. And you know, as far as what you said, I just want to come back to what you said about the telling the truth. And there are lots of things I think that we could do to do a better job of defending it. I don't think that all of our top elected Democrats remind me of those hapless college presidents sitting in front of Elise Stefanik, who didn't first question whether or not, you know, some sophomore getting up and saying, from the river to the sea, whether that would constituted a call for genocide, and what exactly you do with young people, and how had they ignored the anti-Semitism rife within their own party that was at the base of the insurrection. Trump dines with anti-Semites at Mar-a-Lago and does press releases. When will that, is Harvard really more of a threat than that to the country? And these guys just can't get up, and there's so many profound untruths being told. You know, we had a pandemic in which more than a million people died, and they still treat it as a hoax. Climate change is so far beyond theory. We are being ravaged with floods and droughts, and our crops are dying, and the lobster are leaving Maine, and just, you know, the winter's leaving New England.
And the border and the migration, these are all related to climate change, global refugee crisis. These are not two unrelated things, and we have to stress
It's
that.
all there. And even, you know, Lankford, the fellow who is our hero this week for standing up in some ways to his party, you know, is a guy who has consistently called climate change propaganda and myth. They keep sending people who are in such profound denial with nothing to say. Our side has to be better at getting up and making factual arguments. And they're not. And they are like those college presidents, overprepared, formulaic, sloganeering to some degree, a little too concerned about what they think the base thinks, and just too calculating by far.
Those
And so we need to learn how to make a case.
I want to just touch on the college presidents, even though it's news from a while ago, because this is what happens when you go into a political context with a legal argument. And the way you make an opening statement there is you say Harvard University is very concerned about anti-Semitism. And then you cite all the research that the good scholars at Harvard are doing about anti-Semitism, most of which is anti-Semitism on the right. You make that statement. And I say that as a Jew who spends a lot of time at an Ivy League campus, not Harvard, but one of the better ones. But you make that point. And then you make this point about, of course, genocide, calling for genocide is bad, but what are your terms here? Right? A lot of Jews, you know, is calling river from the sea, is that a call for genocide? That's pretty contentious, right? But I don't want to get back into that, but I very much agree. But the Trump, you know, it's very hard to keep track of all the trials of Trump, right? So one of the questions is, how is he going to come up with this $83 million? Will E. Jean Carroll ever see a penny of that? Will he be able to tie this up in the courts, you know, until he has one too many cheeseburgers? And we just don't know the answer to those questions. But there's another case that's coming up in the Supreme Court that to me is fascinating, both because the legal question and also where it might lead us. And that is this insurrection case, this 14th Amendment case. You know, can Trump be on the ballot? The Supreme Court will review the Colorado decision. You know, if I had to bet, I would bet pretty heavily that they're going to say, yes, he could be on the ballot. But it is worth thinking about how they're going to make that argument, because that argument rests on he's not, he didn't, wasn't behind an insurrection. And there's an extraordinarily amount of evidence that he was.
It's amazing, again, the number of utterly specious arguments that are made. They have this somewhat crackpot. It seems like a nice fellow, but a law professor who insists that the president is not an officer of the country. And he says that the founders had made distinctions as to what officer meant in what context that they never wrote down or said out loud, but that he figured out. I mean, it's sort of ultimate conspiracy theory stuff. And of course he's an officer. Did his oath promise to defend the Constitution? They've actually argued that it doesn't. Their biggest argument is that this wasn't really an insurrection. And again, it's sort of like the way Elise Stefanik was playing with language. I don't know how many of the oath keepers and Proud Boys who showed up that day were fluent in the mission. I don't know how many of them thought that they were just there to kill a few people and not overthrow the government, or who thought it was a peaceful protest. I do know that Donald Trump organized that mob and set it on the Capitol in order to stop the government from certifying a valid election.
And to plunge the country into disorder.
Yes.
And violence.
And so an easy way to think of this is, you can listen to their definitions of insurrection or their foolish talk that the people who framed the 14th Amendment were only thinking of the Civil War, completely unsupported by the evidence. And just ask yourself, you could debate it, insurrection, but was this a coup? Okay, because just use the word coup because it was definitely a coup
attempt.
Whether it was an insurrection in the hearts and minds of all the people who foolishly showed up that day, it was absolutely a coup in the mind of Donald Trump and part of an elaborate plan to overturn an election. And then you just have to ask yourself, is a coup an insurrection? And you bet it is. And so if you're going to say they meant insurrections, but not coups, impossible. It's impossible.
I want to make a couple of points here. First, the lawyer for Donald Trump here is named Jonathan Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to make clear a couple things to our listeners. We're not related, first.
Yeah.
But on a more somber note, people who've known me for years know that my brother's name was Jonathan Mitchell. My brother died in 2014, so did not have the chance to vote against Donald Trump. But my brother was many things. We were very close. And it really kind of upsets me to think that this hack, right-wing fascist, has the same name as my late brother. So that's just on a personal note. But you make this point about insurrectionists, and I've worked in many countries where elections are stolen, and I've worked with people who have nonviolently, unlike the people on January 6th, protested because they believed an election was stolen. And sometimes they have succeeded in changing the outcome. So I would point to the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2004 as a good example, 2003, sorry, as a good 2003 and 4, as a good example of this. And this is why, in my view, Trump is uniquely involved in this insurrection, because uniquely as in more than everybody else, because some of those people at that Capitol were sufficiently deluded that they actually believed that the election was stolen. They were so in that right-wing QE world that they believed that. Not all of them. I mean, many of them had much more nefarious intentions. Donald Trump either knew he'd lost the election or was sufficiently mentally incapacitated that he should never have been allowed anywhere near the White House. If it's the latter, well, then obviously he should never be allowed to run for president. He should have been 25th Amendment out years ago. If it's the former, then the weight of the insurrection weighs much, much more heavily on Donald Trump than we are recognizing.
Apparently, an issue being before us for any length of time, the time itself that the issue is before us normalizes the behavior. And it's a process that every one of us succumbs to some degree. It's hard to maintain one's sense of outrage at the familiar. What he's done is so clear. I get up every morning. This morning, my thought was, why hasn't anyone been able to ask Trump if by any chance he or anyone close to him has spoken to Putin lately? Or had any, I do believe that
Tucker Carlson has, though there's that.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson has. I look back at the horrible job that Bob Mueller did, I'm sorry to say, and I think, wow, Donald Trump hires a guy named Paul Manafort, whose last job was working for Putin to overturn an election in the Ukraine. Now, what are the chances of that happening in an American presidential candidate? And then that guy, Manafort, has regular meetings with a Putin intelligence operative / oligarch, and hands him the targeting data, the innermost secrets of the campaign on a regular basis that he clearly takes to go and coordinate. So many felonies in each meeting. And we're still today, years later, the idea that there wasn't collusion that he wasn't actively working with Putin on that election on every level is still, you know, it's still out there. People at best feel unsure.
It's more than that.
Any other analysis is again preposterous.
It's more than that. If you mention this, you're considered having Trump delusion syndrome.
Yes.
Even by people who don't like Trump, they have managed to shout down any discussion of what is obviously, at the very least, a wildly unsavory relationship with a hostile foreign leader, right? At the very least, it's that. And they've mentioned to shout that down just because Trump stood at the White House steps and screamed no collusion loudly and for long enough time.
So just thinking about what comes ahead, we talked about these two questions. One, does he have immunity? And two, does he have a right to be on the ballot? And we don't know how they're going to finally be decided. We'll know, though, I think pretty soon, that the immunity thing's not going to work and the trial is going to go ahead. And I do think, and perhaps I may be deluded in this sense, many of my friends think so, and that is that I still don't think it's a dead certainty that Trump is the nominee. And this has gone longer. I believe that if Jack Smith's Washington trial had been settled by the end of last year, when I first had this thought, if he'd been convicted by the end of last year, he'd be on his way out now. That I do believe that a post-conviction world is very different from a post-indictment world for Trump. I'm not predicting it. I'm just saying that there's a chance here that's greater than we've allowed for. And there are lots of ways in which I wish we'd had a succession plan, if you will. And with our 80-year-old president, you know, Sumner Redstone, Rupert Murdoch, all the other 80-year-old chief executives had elaborate succession plans. I don't feel our party has had one. And I don't know that we'll know what to do in a pinch. I do think Trump will be, and I think, by the way, that if the trial happens on time, we have the right prosecutor, the right case, the right jury pool, the right appeals court, and even the right Supreme Court. I think he loses. And at that point, if he loses and they nominate him anyway, which is likelier than not, but just not a certainty, yes, in my view, I think they'll go ahead and do it. At that point, we could run Bernie Sanders look, talk, and think alikes in every purple district in America and win. Because a Trump convicted of sedition will go down and it'll be a big Democratic day. But there are lots of other possibilities here that are much tougher.
My sense that I half agree with you. Where I disagree with you is I think Trump's going to be the nominee barring a major health crisis. Where I agree with you is that that is very bad news for the Republican Party, because this will seal the election for Biden if he is convicted. The evidence is overwhelming. It'll become more public. This is what the election will be about. But the question of contingencies here is interesting, because a lot of this has to do with timing. You know, because we are moving towards Trump running the table in the Republican primary. Now, I know Nikki Haley just raised $800,000 in California yesterday or last night or the night before. And there are people who think there's some kind of Haley miracle out there. This woman just lost a primary 2-1 to name not on the ballot. In Nevada, right? Name not on the ballot was a surrogate for Trump. Trump is ahead in every Super Tuesday state. She's about to get trounced in her home state. I still believe gets out before that, before she loses in South Carolina. But the reality is that something like 100% of the delegates in the Republican convention, I've skipped my mind where it's going to be, and perhaps Milwaukee. I don't know where it's going to be.
Milwaukee. July 15th to 18th in Milwaukee.
July 15th. You know, my son lives in Wisconsin, so maybe I'll visit him that weekend in Madison. But something around 100%, if not 100%, will be Trump delegates. So if Trump decides cannot be on the ballot, and remember, you can run if you're convicted. You can run if you're indicted. So the timing here has to be, but if something happens, the Republican Party is not going to look around and say, you know, what we need is a rational conservative option. They're going to look around and say, do we want Don Jr.? Do we want Marjorie Taylor Greene? What about Tucker Carlson? He brought some caviar back from Russia for us. I mean, it's really going to be turned over to, you know, MAGA 3.0. This doesn't land on any return to any kind of functioning rational, governance-oriented, albeit way too conservative for my taste, Republican Party.
I agree. I mostly agree. I will say this. A sedition conviction, and the next morning the polls show Biden significantly ahead, because some Republican-leaning voters will have left him because he's been convicted of sedition and therefore shouldn't be president of the United States.
Yes.
And then another bunch are going to leave him because he's who don't really care about that, but they're going to leave him because he's down in the polls. And the theory of their absolute loyalty will be tested at that point. And I still think, if I had to bet, I'd bet on your side. I'd bet that they go ahead. But I do think we have trouble imagining what a post-conviction world would look like for Trump. A post-conviction on the Jack Smith Washington case, the big case. And I do think, if nothing else, it guarantees that 2024 will see the return of appointment television, where we're going to be glued to our sets through the trial, through the convention. If he's been convicted, it'll be even worth the time spent on it. It's going to be extraordinary what will play out.
No, and
I think there will be a civil war within their party. The opposition to Trump, at the very least, will grow. And his anger at all of his dissenters, having lost hundreds of millions of dollars in the New York civil trial by then, and having been convicted of a felony for which he will spend the rest of his life in prison, and facing a somewhat at least muted convention on account of those two outcomes, his fury will be absolutely unstoppable.
As we wrap up here, I want to make two points. First, there is no the Republican Party, right? There's no wise Republicans who now say, Trump, you're going to lose 45 states. We got to get somebody else. There's the delegates who are elected on the Trump slate. They're the ones making the decision. And the second point, which is, I think, less optimistic, is this. We have not thought through what a post-conviction world looks like. We haven't really got our heads around that because we can't really know yet. I agree with you there. The frightening thing is that we haven't thought through what a potential post-acquittal world looks like either.
It looks dark. And I have fewer ideas as to what we can do
right
in that situation.
Remember Mueller? Total exoneration. Remember that absolutely bizarre speech he gave where he was comparing Steve Scalise to Bobby Richardson? Bobby Richardson, for those of you who aren't way, way too deep into the baseball weeds, was a second baseman of the Yankees in the 1960s.
Well, I was going to say shortstop.
No, Tony Kubek was the shortstop on that team.
Of course, yeah.
But very obscure. Can you imagine total exoneration, total hoax, biggest witch hunt in history? That's where this will go. The stakes here are very high. This election, you can say, is Biden going to reach the swing voters in Michigan? How much are the young lefties going to leave him because of the war in Gaza? But this election, and you're right about appointment television. I don't have broadcast television. So for me, it's appointment going on online, which is a problem this Sunday because the one football game a year I really need to watch because my team is playing. But if that ends in acquittal, the stakes are so high that we're not going to be caring about debates. We're going to be caring about what goes on in that courtroom. The courtroom is the new rally for Donald Trump. The courtroom is the new, interview on Fox. The courtroom is the new meet and greet somewhere, reaching out to swing voters. This is where he wants his campaign, not least because it's just so much attention on him every time he has a tantrum in the courthouse. But if this gets wrapped up before the election, which we don't know for sure, and if it ends in acquittal, it could be quite frightening.
There's no question. He would go into autumn with an enormous advantage from an acquittal. And I think that we'd have a very tough time. I think that Joe Biden would have a very tough time dealing with him. And for a long time, I've been of the opinion that Joe Biden, it's not just that he's an 80, but he's not a young 80. And he doesn't make a great presentation. He'd be a vastly better president than Trump, and that's all I will say from that point on when he's nominated. But we should have done. But I would have liked to have seen us at least require a person at that age to take a couple laps around a primary track to show they've still got it. What we can still—that's I know—that's pretty much water under the bridge. We could work on our agenda, which is our other great weakness. And we could speak to immigration. There are things we can say about every major issue that people care about. They're mostly on our side if we have the boldness and the clarity to to actually make the case. I hope that somebody, a Sheldon Whitehouse, a Ro Khanna, I hope some Democrat gets up and forces a real platform debate that puts the Democratic agenda on the table for discussion.
Joe Biden is not a young 80, but he's our 80, and we have to support him for better for worse. It's the only chance we have. We're going to have to wrap up. I've been talking to Bill Curry, an American lawyer and politician, two-time Democratic nominee for governor of Connecticut. Bill, thank you so much for being on the show. Again, I'm Lincoln Mitchell, filling in for Arnie, who is out on assignment. If you want to hear more from me, you can check out my Substack, Keep It Sync with Lincoln. Thank you.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Lincoln.
You better change.